There's a hell of a lot of guys who have tested their 100 watt transmitter by using a dummy load of a 100 watt light bulb or 150 watt light bulb. Works like a charm. It's a little bit spooky on startup because the tungsten, when it's cold, has less than 1/10 the resistance of when it's hot. So the startup is a little spooky. But once you get it running, it's a very good dummy load. And if he had a 1.1 Nisswa with 70 ohm cable, then he should have had something close to a 1.5 or 1.6 Nisswa with 50 ohm cable. And that's still a darn good dummy load, if you know what I mean. It's not a quality 50 ohm resistor where you're going to measure the exact amount of intermodulation distortion of the final stage of your transmitter because it's being properly loaded. Then again, with an antenna tuner, no sweat. With a good antenna tuner, you can probably tolerate a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. And it wouldn't matter if it's highly inductive, highly capacitive, 5 ohms of resistance, or 500 ohms of resistance. Each one of those is roughly a 10 to 1, but it almost wouldn't matter. If you've got a high enough dynamic range antenna tuner, it'll take every one of those things that I just described and bring it down to 50 ohms and keep the transmitter happy. And 98% of the power you generate will end up in that dummy load making heat. So impedance matching, once you understand what you're doing, is nowhere near as difficult as you would think. And one of the things that I keep telling people that they don't know about, let me drop. You talk to the average antenna engineer with 10 years of experience, or you talk to the average amateur radio operator with 20 years of experience, and you tell him, I want you to build me a dipole, but my particular piece of coax cable happens to be 10 ohm. And by the way, you can buy that from the Uniform Tubes Company. You can buy 10 ohm surge impedance coaxial cable. I want you to use 10 ohm coaxial cable, and I want you to feed that dipole with it for me. And the average guy will think that, well, to get that kind of a ratio of a 70 ohm dipole, and I got to bring it down to 10 ohms, I got to use all these mechanical structures of a triple type folded dipole, or a modification of a gamma match or a T match. They go through all of these mechanical structures to get the impedance match. They somehow haven't realized that all they had to do is change the length of the dipole by making it shorter, and it will come down to 5 ohms of resistive component. And when you do that, when it's shorter, it'll be capacitive. And now you put the right size inductor across the gap on the dipole, like with a hairpin, and now the inductance disappears, and the antenna is perfectly impedance matched. It doesn't take fancy, complicated mechanical structures if you know what you're doing. And what I just said is a well-kept secret. Very few people know about that. You read the article that's at the bottom end of the A1 MBA website, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. You go to the bottom of the page where it says K2RIW Yagi matching, and you'll find the 2,000 words that explains this with the two curves that tells you how to do it. It's an extremely well-kept secret. Make sure you don't tell anybody. Over to you for any comments on this, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, repeater.
K2AV.
I think it was KD2AVU. Is that true, Tim?
Yes, that's a Roger, Dick. And for the impedance matching, I was doing some experimenting with the NFAT 2-meter half-wave antenna. And I'm using that antenna right now. I used a Pi network to match the impedance at the end of the half-wave length of aluminum tubing. And I know exactly what you're saying there. Dick, over to you, K2RW, KD2AV, over.
Right on, Tim. That so-called Pi network you used, that is an antenna tuner. If you take apart the majority of the antenna tuners you can buy, inside there is either a Pi network or a Pi L network. Properly designed, a Pi has a huge amount of range of impedances it will match. The real impedance could be too low, too high. Highly capacitive, highly inductive, and a well-designed Pi network will do all of that impedance matching for you and waste none of your power in the process. Are you aware that your Pi network was almost exactly what's inside of most antenna tuners? Were you aware of that ahead of time, Tim? KD2AVU, K2LIW?
Yeah, I do aware of that, and I was using two variable capacitors and also inductor, but I do notice something today. I was testing the antenna on a non-conductive antenna mast, and I had to shorten the inductor length, today when I doing the actual installation, it was on the conductive mast, so I had to make the length, inductor length a little bit longer. So that's just some observation of the Pi network, but it worked very well for SWR lower than 1.5 to 1. I'm getting almost 6 megahertz off that. And I guess it's working. And the standard frequency is 146 megahertz, and it takes 150 watts to test it. Over to you, Dick.
I think you said you had to shorten the radiator, the thing that's really doing the transmitting. What made you think you had to shorten that, Tim? Is it because your two capacitors or your inductor, that something in your Pi network ran out of range? You either went to maximum capacitance or minimum capacitance on one of the capacitors. Did it run out of range? Is that what told you you had to change the length of the radiator? Over to you, Tim, K2LIW.
2RW, KD2AVU. Let me drop first. 2RW, KD2AVU, returning. I was saying I have to make the inductor length a little bit longer, not the radiator. The radiator is 38.5 inches. I didn't touch that after I make the length. Over.
Okay, you had to make the inductor longer, which I guess means you added some turns. You increased the amount of inductance. Is it the thing that drove you into increasing the amount of inductance that your capacitors ran out of range? You went to maximum capacitance and it wasn't enough? Is that what you're saying, Tim? Go ahead.
No, actually, I left the capacitors as it is when I was adjusting the antenna on a non-conductive antenna mast. But during the actual installation, it was on the aluminum antenna mast and also a piece of pipe that is for the satellite dish already on my roof. When the antenna is in place, the antenna mast and all the structures are all metal. For some reason, I'm getting a 3-to-1 SWR. So, I had to adjust the inductor to lower the SWR reading. I guess, because I'm changing the grounding on that antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, the inductor that's in the Pi network, you keep saying you made it longer, which I think means you added more turns to it, or you stretched it out, one or the other. What told you it had to be longer? If it didn't have to be longer, and you found the right combination of the C1 capacitor and the C2 capacitor, you'd get an impedance match. The only way I know that you would be told by your measurements that for that particular antenna as a load, you had to increase the inductor would be one or the other of your capacitors hit maximum and you didn't yet get the complete match that you wanted. The capacitors running out of range tells you that the inductor has to be increased. So did you see one of your capacitors run out of range as you were approaching the match but didn't quite get there? Over to you, Tim, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KD2AV, returning. Yes, it was the C2 ran out of range. C2 is, I believe it's 3 picofarad to 40 picofarad, and the C2 ran out of range. It was at the minimum of the capacitance. Back to you, Dick.
If adding inductance fixed it, then you had to be running out of range by the capacitor at maximum, and you didn't have enough. You needed more than 40. Because as you add more inductance, in general, your capacitors have to go to a lower number. If it was already at minimum, something doesn't quite ring true, as you can tell. Over to you, Tim.
I think a C2 is the capacitor close to the, I mean, on the right side of the Pi network, and C1 is the left one, left capacitor on the Pi network. So, but the, I think it's C2, because C1, I was using a, 20 to 120 picofarad, and it was right around 30 or something, maybe a little bit less than that. But the C2 is at the minimum 3 picofarad. Over.
Yeah, usually C1 is called the tuning capacitor, and C2 is called the loading capacitor. It's called that because it's closer to the output. And the tuning capacitor is the one closest to the input. Okay, you found the solution by changing the inductor and using the capacitors you've got. And now if they don't run out of range at max or min, my guess is you're able to make it go all the way to 1.1 standing wave ratio. Is that true, Tim?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I made a mistake. Actually, I ran out of range on the C2. It's and the C2, the loading capacitor. I ran out of range on that, and the C1 is just a little bit about the minimum. Back to you, Dick.
Understand. Okay, so you've got an antenna tuner. That sounds like it's at least partially homebrew. Let's see if Paul is there, and what's NASA doing these days, Paul? WS2M. K2RIW in the TechNet, you got a phone.
Okay, very good, Dick. This is WS2N. Yeah, Dick, the, there's not much going on. There's a lot of robotic missions and things like that to follow. But a manned spaceman mission since the shuttle ended is, of course, a problem. So we follow the International Space Station. We'll follow the launches of the Russian and eventually the commercial spacecraft will be able to take Americans from American soil, and then we'll be back to normal the way it's been for years with the shuttle operation. We had about 2-3 flights a year back in the boom days. I think they made it up to 6 flights in 1 year. So right now commercial people are struggling to attain that goal. NASA money is still coming forward. So that seed money for the commercial industry just had another, want to call it a viewing of the Boeing CST-100 being built by Boeing. Let me drop it. Their spacecraft is going to carry, they all will have the capability of carrying 7 people, but Boeing is being given money by NASA, as well as a couple of the other companies, but they had a picture come out of what it's going to look like on the inside. I've seen what the outside would look like, but they actually have a spacecraft that, you know, what they believe to be the best. And when you look inside, there's not a million switches and gauges all over everywhere. They have tablets, LED lighting, plenty of room for people to get in. You'll have 3 people sitting basically on the top, 4 kind of below them at the max. I don't know if they'll ever achieve that. You know, it might not be a demand for it, but they have that capability. And very nice picture of what it's going to look like on the inside. That came out on the NASA site a few days ago. So hopefully by 2017, Boeing, I'd like to see it earlier, but we'll be able to have a first flight on an Atlas rocket from Cape Canaveral down in Florida. A couple of other things that are following the progress there. Ship just went up a couple of days ago and has already docked with the International Space Station. This goes up at least 2 times a year. Drop it. Closer to 3 times a year. And they now follow the same routine that the Soyuz manned spacecraft is doing. These progress ships, it used to take 2 days, a little over 2 days, and then they would dock with the space station. Now it takes about 8 hours. They do 4 orbits and quickly have these things dock with the space station. There's usually about at least 2 progress crafts attached to the space station at a time, and they're always filling up one with garbage. And they do that with a lot of the ones that come up. The Japanese have one, the H2, that's like a progress cargo type of ship. And then only 5 times the European Space Agency has sent up an ATV, an automatic transport vehicle, over the years. When they go up, it's at least 3 times the mass of the progress ship, and it usually stays attached for 6 months or even up to a year, and then they'll detach it with garbage and burn it up over the Pacific. So much for the cargo situation with the space station. I've been following the robotic mission. WS2N. There's a lot of them out there. But I was just reading about the Juno spacecraft. Every once in a while they'll fly their rocket for about a couple of seconds. And that's not to reorient the spacecraft but do anything special, but just to purge the lines, to get contaminants out of the lines. I didn't realize that they did that. But every now and then they'll do that with this thing. This thing launched a couple of years ago. And it's been going around Earth orbit. It went around once. It's already come back, and now it's going to have another, it's going to have an Earth flyby in October. So, I mean, it's roughly about, it's been at about 1/3 to the distance to Jupiter a while back, and now it's on its way back, and in October it'll be very close to Earth, and Earth will give it a gravity assist to push it all the way out to Jupiter to go into a polar orbit. I think it's around 2015, so a couple of years from now we'll be talking about the Juno mission in that polar orbit, 33 orbits, and that'll be it for that. But it's a very big spacecraft, probably about 120, 130 feet long, solar paneled and all. So that's going to be, we'll follow that about 2 years from now, but I just wanted to follow it because it's coming up in October. different antennas on.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So long enough time to do anything. So they use the omnidirectional ones that are attached to the spacecraft. Drop it. And that'll be, that's pretty much it for Juno. John brought up a topic I was talking to him earlier. By the way, John, I didn't get your email, but I know what you're talking about. It's always the topic of the sun having a nemesis. A nemesis sun out there. You know, someday going to come by and maybe smash into it or something. But that theory has been around for many decades. I remember them talking about that probably, in the 80s or something. They believed it was out by the Oort cloud, other sun, orbiting, like we're a double star. It's never been found. I mean, we've found other planets besides Pluto and things like that, but we haven't found a sun out there. And I think they were talking about 1.5 light years, so that would be out by the Oort cloud, way behind the Kuiper belt. But, do that story, John, and maybe you're talking about the Orpheus story where that's the one where this planet, Mars-sized planet, most likely crashed into the Earth during the formation of the solar system, created the moon. That's the latest, the probable theory right now of what went on. And that name of that planet, or that theoretical planet, sometimes they give it Orpheus, but if it's the sun nemesis one, let me drop it. It's probably the one that you're talking about. That's probably out 1.5 light years, because many years ago, before we knew anything about anything, I think they always thought there was another sun right behind. Another planet right behind the sun. It's similar to Earth. It was called Vulcan, And the reason we didn't see it was always on the other side of the sun. Of course, that's been proven. It does not exist. So, those couple of stories are about all I have. We're really looking forward to a manned space program, an American space program, hopefully 2016 maybe would be the earliest. Back to you, Dick, WSLN. I'll be here for questions. Let me drop it 1 second. I'll give out the email that I think John was going to use. Anytime anybody wants to contact me, you can use spacenetreport@gmail.com. So, not the TechNet, but SpaceNet Report, part of the TechNet, spacenetreport@gmail.com, and you could always bring up topics like we've just spoken about. Dick, any questions or anything, I'll be here, WS2N.
I've heard it said, but I'm not sure why, the new Progress mission, which used to take 2 to 3 days to link up with the International Space Station to do docking was like 2 to 3 days, and now it's done in some number of hours. What changed to make it so much better? Paul, go ahead.
Well, they knew they could always do it, but the accuracy has improved with all these launches, probably maybe 100 launches up to the space station, I guess. They're able to know they're going to hit their mark. At one time when they weren't as accurate, they used too much fuel or too little fuel. I think they would have missed, and then it would have been a problem to recorrect that failure if they missed their target. And it would probably cost me more fuel, or maybe it wouldn't have even worked. So to be safe, all the launches were always 2 or 3 days, even the shuttle launches. This way they had more leeway. They could, good. It was easier to correct. Now they're so accurate, and it's really nice because, you know, to spend 2-3 days in a Soyuz spacecraft with three astronauts crammed on top of one another, I mean, they do have, there is like another room. You launch in this round sphere, and then, you know, once you're in orbit, you can float to the other, to the front sphere. And you know, you've got your bathroom there, you know, eating. I mean, they're not just sitting in these seats for 3 days, but it's still a pretty cramped environment for 2-3 days. Now they can do it in like 8 hours. That's, you know, like a work day in the dock. That's great. Thank you, sir.
K2YO question.
You got it, Bernie.
Well, I'm curious when you say that they were concerned about their accuracy or they might miss. What are the types of things that would cause them to miss?
I would think too much fuel, maybe a rocket not shutting down on time, a late launch, an early launch, something happened, you know, by split second. That's the way I've heard it. You know, they started this about 2 years ago, Bernie. So a rocket, not a failure, but something not working as good as they want. You know, maybe a thruster misfiring. Who knows? Some inaccuracy. Just, you know, there was less of a room for failure. When they described it a couple of years ago, when they started doing this, you know, if you were gonna, you know, shoot a rifle, and the distance is far enough away, you know, the accuracy is you could get in the ballpark, you know, and then if you were gonna shoot it again, you'd be pretty close to where you want to be. But if the area is, you know, if it's going to be a close area to you, you get your time. The time cuts everything down. Or if you're golfing, I always thought of it as golfing. You know, if you hit the ball, you know, you hit it with a driver, and you know, you've got 3 or 4 shots to get into the hole, not bad. If you want to do it in one shot, you better be right the first time. You know, if you only allowed one shot. Back to you, Bernie.
Okay, so you're saying it's more process errors or, shall we say, machinery errors that are challenges that would cause a miss. What I was looking for was did environmental actions have impact on this? And you didn't discuss that, so I'll assume that they do not. I will take a slight exception to your rifle shot idea because that involves a huge amount of environmental issues. Whereas very unlikely the gun or the bullet will fail, but it's very likely the wind will move it downrange somewhere, etc. But it sounds like on these missions that it's reliability of the spacecraft is the ability for the process to duplicate exactly the same. It's not that the wind at the high altitude matters or that those kind of things impact. Is that correct?
Yeah, I agree. And machinery is the best way I've heard it. That's very good. The environment has nothing to do with it, as far as I know now. They got bigger problems when it comes to environment. They just lost the a proton rocket. They had three satellites in it about a month ago. This thing went up, didn't go too far, came back down and blew up not too far away from the launch pad. These are bigger. You know, the proton rockets are bigger than the Soyuz rockets that they're launching. That's their heavy lifting vehicle. And I think the Soyuz rockets are so reliable. I mean, even the European Space Agency is starting to buy them, and they're launching them from French Guiana in South America. They're so reliable. They don't have any problems. So I guess they're able to do that. Now, one of the reasons they want to do it is now they have more fuel. Not only, you know, case there is a problem, they have that fuel on board, make it dock with the space station, and every rocket that goes up there, before they leave, they'll use their rocket to boost the space station up higher. So now they have additional fuel to do that, especially now without the shuttle. The shuttle used to really do a good job. They always had a lot of fuel. And I know that's a consideration that I've heard.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I assume that if they do miss, because they have this extra fuel on board, if they have to go around, they can. And they can make, worst case, they meet them on the other side of the world. So very interesting. I am just continually appalled by the subjects. Not appalled, but amazed by the subjects. You talk about a rocket or a spaceship that went a third of the way to Jupiter, came all the way back, cycled around Earth, and is going to hit Jupiter. I'm just amazed at the mathematics that people are capable of doing to be able to predict that in three-dimensional space with orbital mechanics. My hats are off to them, and my hats are off to gentlemen like you, Paul, that understand this stuff. K2YO, thank you.
Very good, Brian. Well, I'm just as amazed. All these types of missions that where they need to save fuel, they do these flybys, and they've been doing that for decades. They've done it with Galileo. They've done it with the which went to Jupiter as well. They've done it with Cassini, which is orbiting Saturn right now. But what's nice in the future, they have the SLS coming up, and you know, in the year 2020, you'll be able to NASA will launch the SLS, the Space Launch System, which will be bigger than the Apollo rockets. And if they want to do a mission to Saturn, no problem. You won't see the gravity assist like you're seeing now. You'll be able to make a direct shot and use 7 years to get to Saturn, which is the timetable now. You can probably do it in four. Dick, over to you.
I've got one question, Paul. That is, you mentioned that a manned mission is going to take place in 2016. Now, if it was just another group of guys going to the International Space Station, I don't think you would call it out separately. A manned mission at 2016, where are they going to go, Paul? US2N, K2LAW?
The first manned mission, well, I'm pushing for 2016. The actual date now is 2017. But I'm thinking with the competition they got going on, somebody's going to pull ahead. You've got Boeing with the CST 100. It's a similar looking spacecraft that you would see, like the Apollo, but bigger, more room here inside. And then you've got SpaceX with Dragon. More of a gumdrop size. That looks more like a Gemini spacecraft to me, but basically, a flying body. And again, with seven people on board, so they're competing. Along with them, you have Sierra Nevada coming out of California. Correction, out of Colorado, and SpaceX comes out of Hawthorne, California, but. Sierra Nevada actually comes out of Colorado with the Dream spacecraft. That's going to be, looks like a small shuttle type of thing. And that they all will carry seven people. Let me drop it. But most likely, I think they'll be carrying three or four at the most, and then cargo. All these spacecraft have the ability to carry both. So if you want to put two guys in and a bunch of cargo, you could do that. I think that's going to be probably what's going to go on. Maybe two or three guys and cargo. You'll be able to switch crews. It's going to leave NASA out of the loop as far as restocking the space station. And that's where the early ones are going to go. Now, Bigelow, that's another company. They're working on that in the future. And also, SpaceX already has some plans on independent missions, you know, just science missions to be dropping. Where they'll go up and they'll orbit, they won't go to a space station, and then maybe they'll come back. I mean, they have actual plans on doing those types of things. So they'll be working for NASA, supplying the International Space Station. Maybe they'll be bringing equipment up to and supplying the Bigelow space station. A lot going on. Bigelow has this inflatable system. That's what I'm talking about with their space station. In fact, he's got one going up in 2014 or maybe early 2015. He's got an inflatable one that's going to attach to the International Space Station as a prototype to see how it works out. In fact, Dragon, SpaceX, will be bringing that up. They've already got the contract to bring that up to the ISS. So, where are they going? They'll go to the space station or space stations. You never know. Back to you, Dick.
I just suddenly realized that I had forgotten about the fact that all of these commercial space launching groups are essentially in competition with each other, although some are leading. And so therefore the first manned mission really means the first time they put a man on one of those particular multi-man vehicles. And the real destination as I see it now is the International Space Station. I somehow got confused and thought that there's a manned mission to somewhere else. Well, other than the International Space Station or to go to Hubble to do a repair, I was having great trouble believing that the manned mission was going to go to Mars, no way. Moon, I doubt it. Hubble, I doubt it. So it had to be International Space Station. Now I understand. It's manning these new vehicles. Thank you, Paul. As I said earlier, you guys want to, in the next week or so, find that NASA site, which is science@nasa.org. It's a basic site, but the exact article itself is called Perseid Fireballs. It was issued on July 26, 2013. Very nice article about Perseid is by far the biggest meteor shower. Let me drop it. Where those meteors are has the highest number of fireballs. They hit the Earth at 132,000 miles an hour. I did a quick calculation to try to figure out where that number came from. The Earth going around the Sun moves at 66 2/3 thousand miles an hour. 66.661 miles per hour is what the Earth moves around the Sun. And if the meteors were moving at the exact same speed in the other direction, 65,000 miles an hour, while we move 66,000 miles an hour, and they're head-on, you meet at 132,000. Overly coincidental. Yeah, we're moving around the Sun at 18.5 miles per second, 66,000 miles an hour. Okay, as I said, that's a real good article. I didn't play the whole tape. Let me drop.
And Dick, if you look at the diagram, it looks like it's intersecting. I don't know where they're getting that 132,000 either. Just to let you know.
If they were close to head-on, it would be easy. And if they're not head-on, as long as the pieces of junk coming from Comet Swift-Tuttle, that's what really makes the Perseid meteor shower. Comet Swift-Tuttle is a comet that is 26 kilometers in diameter. It's a whopper of a comet. You don't want that one hitting the Earth. But the pieces that come off of it are what we're encountering during these meteor showers. And so these fireballs, the Perseid meteor shower gives you a significant number of fireballs at magnitude minus 2.7, which is a lot brighter than Sirius, the star Sirius. I think it's essentially the brightness of Venus. So really good things. So exactly head on, and as long as the meteors are moving a little bit faster, you can still keep meeting that 133,000. When you look at the amount of heat that's created during an atmospheric encounter, you look at the size of the object, the amount of heat it creates, and the trail length and so on, you work out that mathematics. There's multiple ways you can tolerate, you can test 132,000, as well as radar tracking, and they do all of the above. So I think the 132,000 is probably a real number, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, it looked like it was coming in on the side, you know, like sides, like the meteors were going to side swipe. It's like, I know we're going 66,000 miles an hour one way, but it looks like we're almost like going in the same direction. So that's what it looked like. But very good there. Yeah, I think they said middle of August sometime, 13th, I think. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the peak of the shower is on August 12th and 13th. However, this particular Swiss tunnel is so big, and it's been shedding so many chunks of it, that days ahead of time and days afterwards, you will still see some of those meteors, some of those fireballs. It's not one of these very brief meteor showers where for 20 minutes you get a whole lot of meteors and you got to make sure you don't blink, if you know what I mean. Now, Wes and 2XJN didn't suggest that we look at a particular tape. I didn't see the whole tape, but I saw portions of it. And it's on the subject of cavitation. Let me drop. Cavitation has really got some surprising characteristics to it. I first encountered the concept of cavitation when way back in the dark ages I wanted to build an ultrasonic cleaner, an ultrasonic transducer. In other words, at an ultrasonic rate, you make this strong magnetic field on strips of nickel. Nickel is a magnetostrictive material. You change the magnetic field, and nickel will change its length. So it's capable of acting like a loudspeaker, but it can produce tremendous forces. And you literally take a stainless steel pot and bend the bottom of the pot at an ultrasonic rate, and you get a fluid inside, and with the ultrasonic cleaner, you can do some very good cleaning because of cavitation. Cavitation is where you're instantaneously forming bubbles that collapse, and those very small bubbles that collapse because of the ultrasonic excitation of that kind of a cleaner can really blast dirt off the surface of jewelry or whatever. And a fast-moving propeller in water will also create cavitation. So cavitation, there's all kinds of very fancy computer programs. Let me drop some very fancy computer programs the United States invented in order to make the propellers on submarines and ships quiet, not to cavitate. Very difficult solution. Very fancy computer programs were required to do that. And for a while, there was a great big flap about whether or not we were selling those computers to foreign nationals, to foreign nations, and therefore they would, by way of those use of those computers, possibly have a way of finding also finding the solution to our anti-cavitating propellers. In the case of a submarine, you really don't want the propeller cavitating because the sonar equipment on the other submarine is going to be listening to you and know exactly where you are and how fast you're moving and how fast you're spinning the propeller and so on. You'd rather not have them know all that information during wartime. So you really want to make silent propellers that have no cavitation. But cavitation is an extremely violent phenomena at the microscopic level, and because of those collapsing bubbles making tremendous instantaneous pressures, it can do some pretty fancy things of creating a lighting and whatever in certain fluids. Let me drop. And now, if I understand correctly, Wes, the video implies that the cavitation is so violent, it's making such high temperatures that it's becoming a nuclear event. In other words, it's not affecting just the outer orbit of the electrons around individual atoms and molecules, that it's somehow penetrating the nucleus, where ordinarily you need the velocity of a particle accelerator, like the Large Hadron Collider, to do that. And I think the article is implying that cavitation is a violent enough reaction that it can become a nuclear reaction. Is that sort of what's being claimed? And maybe that's real. So give us some words on that one, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the tech net.
C2IS, comment.
Go ahead, Bill.
I believe there's a buzzword here, sonoluminescence. And the last time I heard anything about it, that was the description for, or the word applied to, the light that you get during these cavitation events. And I don't think they had an explanation for where the light came from. Don't know if there's been progress on that.
Yeah, this YouTube video did exactly use those words, sonoluminescence. And a very minor form of that. If you've ever gone swimming in the salt water at nighttime, and you wave your hand through the water real fast, you'll see lighting. And I believe in that case, it's the marine animals that are the microscopic animals in the seawater that's doing that. But in the case of cavitation sonoluminescence, it turns out that at the microscopic level, the collapsing bubbles of cavitation is an extremely violent event, and as such it produces instantaneous pressures that are through the ceiling, so to speak. What you're really doing with cavitation, is my understanding, is that as that bubble collapses, as the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall of the bubble comes together, so to speak, at a very high speed, you're attempting to compress a fluid, and as you can tell by the locked rotor you get with an air conditioner under certain conditions, fluids really don't want to be compressed. Unless you're willing to produce zillions of pounds per square inch, you can't compress a fluid. So in the process of the collapsing bubble trying to do that, the instantaneous pressures goes to such high shock-like pressure that, if I understand correctly, it can create literally light. I guess you could say that the amount of energy being dissipated in that bubble is a little bit like what you've got with the plasma inside of a fluorescent tube or the filament of an incandescent light bulb getting into some extremely high temperatures because of the instant...
Repeater, timeout.
The extremely high pressures are giving you instantaneous temperatures that are very high, and therefore you get a light out of it. You make the temperature of the filament high enough, you get light. So you make the temperature of the bubble that's collapsing high enough, you get light out of it. And so I think you're saying, Bill, that in the articles you've read, the explanation for where the light is coming from is not exactly clear, not exactly quantified. Is that what you're saying, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW?
AC2IS here. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I did not actually read anything on the subject, but I knew some people at Stony Brook, and their physics department was working on this problem, thinking about 10 years ago. And yeah, my understanding is that the source of the light was unknown. There were very high temperatures. Also, sonoluminescence events were supposedly very damaging to the screw or the propeller on, for example, a submarine.
Yes, not necessarily the sonoluminescence is damaging, just the pure cavitation. Cavitation creates instantaneous pressures. As somebody told me, it's half a million pounds per square inch, I believe it. You get really big numbers. And that, in turn, is capable of taking chunks out of your propeller, digging divots in it, so to speak, if I understand correctly. So it is a damaging phenomenon of your nautical machinery, and you'd really rather not have it happen. By extremely precise design of the shape of a propeller, done by very fancy computer programs that are doing computational fluid dynamics calculations. These supercomputers, in theory, can give you an optimized shape of a propeller that at your particular desired RPM for your particular state of the water, temperature, pressure, salinity, and whatever, you won't get cavitation. I know there was a huge effort 10 or so years ago to design exotic propellers that would not cavitate at high velocity. Anyway, any further comments or questions on all of the above? I only saw, I guess, the first third or so of that YouTube video. I had the impression that you saw a greater percentage of it, and maybe you've got an impression of what's going on there, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Yes, Dick, KC2WGB. I watched the whole video, and there's also a lot of written material that he emailed also. I don't think you'll ever have time to read it all. But his claim is that that process is creating neutron. That's what Wesley was going to bring up tonight, to prove the fact that we don't need high temperature or high voltage to do these. The computer programs that cut those propellers are done on 9-axis millimeter.
I found a way of listening to what's going on. The propagation has changed tonight, and my full duplex receiver is having trouble hearing 147.375. So I missed some of what you said because the machine is in the turn-off mode, John. So modify again the second half of the movie. You're starting to tell us that I think they were saying that this cavitation was creating free neutrons or a nuclear event. Is that true? Here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I'm hearing you right now because of a pilot error. On your previous transmission, I was not hearing you when the machine went into the off mode. Yeah, because the cavitation is such a violent event, and because it generates instantaneous pressures and temperatures that are so high, I'm not going to say that this is crazy. I think it's possible that neutrons could be liberated by that event. I'm going to look a little bit further into that one. Now, up till now, we've said you need extremely high temperatures and high voltages to create a nuclear event, to make X-rays, for instance. Well, it turns out that cavitation does have extremely high pressures, extremely high temperatures, doesn't have high voltage, but maybe it doesn't need it. So cavitation, I think, is a possibility there, John. What do you think? Yeah, we know that the cavitation does create instantaneous pressures and temperatures where the temperature is extremely high. Okay? We got to keep remembering that temperature isn't just something that's measured by a thermometer. The thermometer is telling you the average kinetic energy of those molecules, i.e. velocity. So if you've got an extremely high temperature, you do, by definition, have molecules moving very fast. Therefore, at the microscopic level, maybe these are microscopic particle accelerators, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, K2LIW. Yeah, when it comes to efficiency, which gets into cross-section and numbers, the amazing thing to me is that you take that biggest machine in the world, Large Hadron Collider, and you got 2,800 bundles. Each bundle has got, 10 to the 35 protons in there, and you're making these bundles as absolutely smallest in diameter as you can. You focus them the very best you can. and you got one beam going clockwise and one beam going counterclockwise. Therefore, you've got the tightest possible beam, the best possible aiming, and you're aiming directly at each other for head-on collision. Common sense would lead you to believe the collision takes place and it's all over in a couple of seconds. Well, they line up that machine with all of that quality of alignment of all of those bundles, and then you wait 24 hours. You then wait 24 hours for a certain percentage of the collisions to take place. What's really happening is really like two galaxies colliding. There's so much empty space between the stars that very little real impact takes place. And it's what's going on with these counter-rotating bundles in the Large Hadron Collider. 24 hours of running on one loading of the machine. And even then, I bet you only half the collisions have taken place. Over to you, John. T2LIW. Yeah, what's hard to fathom in that situation is that this beam is made out of particles so small that you don't stand a chance of seeing them. You can't photograph them, not even with an X-ray machine, so to speak. So they're so small you can't see them, and yet they're moving fast, relativistically speaking, that there's a huge amount of energy that they contain. And it takes you a long period of time to build up that energy in that beam. It's almost the smallest possible particles at the highest possible velocity with the best possible focusing, and you said 30%? I'll bet you the collision efficiency on a per proton rate is probably an efficiency of 10 to the minus 20. You and I, you know, 0.1901 as the efficiency, obvious by the fact that the zillions of protons are heading directly toward each other, head-on collisions, for 24 solid hours, and you've only used up a certain percentage of everything you put into that machine. Over to you, John, K2IIW. Well, this is the biggest machine with the best focusing. It's the best machine you've ever had to do that work. And so, if you're going to tell the backers ahead of time that, hey, what they're trying to do is difficult, and therefore they can bail out, you don't want to word it that way, John. If you really want to do this kind of research, you got to pay your dues. This is it. I don't think there's any other way. Over to you, John. Yeah. You never know where pure research is going to go. If you've got the curiosity to find out what's at the bottom, assuming there is a bottom, you're going to get to the bottom of it all. Assuming there is a bottom and you find it, guarantee sometime downrange you'll find a way of using it. Knowledge on some subject that you didn't anticipate is never wasted. Somebody will find a way of using it someday. You may not get rich on it, but still, this universe is not easy to understand. He did not make it easy, John. I think he's created a puzzle that's going to keep mankind busy for the amount of years that you and I can't even write on a piece of paper. Over to you. Disappointed to hear that your 8405, your vector voltmeter, vector voltmeter, was not troublesome for you. I know that getting the probes for it is very tough. I know it's got a tough alignment procedure. I know that if it's not working right, it can be a pretty persnickety machine. What was it doing to you, John, that made you bail out? Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.